wish to be with no evil man. For then come the day when you'll be weeped at the feather's end. Leave a brute children.
Next week. Simple, same time. Positive vibes, keep you alive. 90.3 FM. From 3 to 5.
My head is anointed.
My brother Sampalo. Salibon next week. My brand is to tune in the seats.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And you're listening to a very special edition of this month's Labor Radio here on CKUT's Off the Hour, Thursday, March 18th. And this is your co-host, Mustafa Hanaway.
And I'm Stefan Doucette.
And before we talk about our interviews, this is the week where we, you know, we reach out to our community, of listeners, to help and continue to support CKUT 90.3 FM, because it's a non-corporate radio station that's always been part of the community and relying on the community and not on corporate advertising. And this is a special year where we can't actually do the kind of the fundraising that we do when we're in studio. But for those, they can always call in 448-4041. Or they can go online, ckut.ca slash donate. And this year, you know, sowing the seeds of change. And that's the theme that we're going on. And if people want, if they can donate anywhere between $30, gets you an entry to the grand prize. $60 will get you one entry to the grand prize. $90 will get you a t-shirt and a tote bag and an entry into the grand prize, or even $20 a month to $40 a month. Anything really helps. There's a whole series of prizes in terms of CDs, gift certificates, and books. So we really need your support. It helps pay for everything from the radio equipment to the rent to the water. So really, CKUT wouldn't be here without you. So anything helps and keeps this radio program and the whole station going. So please give what you can for this year's funding drive.
That's right. And you, like Mustafa said, you wouldn't be getting the kind of programming you're getting without your contributions. And what you're getting today from us here on Labor Radio is a jam-packed show that I'm very happy that we're able to bring you to showcase kind of the special edition. It's three different interviews. First, we'll be hearing from Alexandre Courtois, who's a teacher at the Institut Maritime du Québec, talking about the sort of conditions of people working in maritime shipping during the COVID crisis and just maritime shipping working conditions in general. We got Marion Miller from the Progressive Educator Workers in Education talking about what's going on with the strike votes of all the teachers and educators in the province. And also finally, Simon Black, the lead organizer of Labor Against the Arms Trade, talking about their campaign, trying to organize labor against the arms industry in Canada, and particularly against the Saudi arms deal that's sort of Canada's main contribution to the genocidal war in Yemen. So that's what you'll be hearing on the show today.
Bon, on était rejoint via Zoom avec notre camarade Alexandre Courtois de Rimouski, enseignant à l'Institut Maritime du Québec, syndiqué avec la FEC, associée à la CSQ, mais aussi marin, officier de navigation. Donc, merci Alex de t'être, d'avoir pris le temps de t'entretenir avec nous. On va parler un peu des impacts de la COVID sur l'industrie maritime, à la fois au Québec qu'à l'échelle mondiale, qui est quand même une industrie extrêmement importante pour la société en général, mais aussi très importante au niveau du capital international. Donc, sans trop rentrer là-dedans au début, là, on va commencer tranquillement. Peux-tu peut-être te présenter puis parler un peu de cette importance-là du transport marin puis du marché marin au Québec? Peut-être les liens entre les deux, l'importance, comme je dis, du transport maritime. Qu'est-ce que tu en penses? C'est quoi, donne-nous un peu une image là, de cette industrie-là.
Oui, absolument. Ben, moi, c'est comme on disait, c'est Alexandre Courtois. Donc, oui, justement, je continue de pratiquer mon métier sur les navires et de l'enseigner. Fait que c'est quelque chose que j'apprécie beaucoup. L'industrie maritime, effectivement, on va dire que les marchandises en tant que telles, au long de leur chemin, parce que dans le fond, quand ils sont construites, sont construites dans une manufacture qui ne sont pas nécessairement dans le même pays. Fait que dans le fond, je vous donne l'exemple, par exemple, des alumineries. Les alumineries, il y en a beaucoup au Québec parce qu'on sait que l'énergie est relativement peu chère. Donc, on va aller, par exemple, au Brésil charger ce qu'on appelle de l'alumine ou de la bauxite. On va l'apporter ici au Québec, puis ensuite de ça, on va la transformer. Fait que généralement, un produit, que ce soit de la matière première, que ce soit à la manufacture ou au transit ensuite de ça là, pour les marchés, ben, bon, au moins 90% des marchandises qui se transigent dans le monde vont passer par un navire. Fait que c'est vraiment grand. Ici au Canada particulièrement parce que on a la comment est-ce qu'on appelle ça? On a la voie d'eau, là, la voie maritime du Saint-Laurent, en fait, qui nous appelle, qui amène en fait finalement la voie au marché là, des États-Unis, donc par exemple Chicago, tout ça. Donc, c'est les villes qu'on a dans les grands lacs canadiens. Fait que, dans le fond, faut passer par le fleuve Saint-Laurent pour rentrer. On a aussi la côte ouest, où on va avoir énormément là, de transit qui va être fait là, avec les pays asiatiques, entre autres. Puis aussi, il y a la réalité des communautés nordiques. Donc, les communautés nordiques sont très, très isolées. Donc, on parle, par exemple, là, des peuples inuits, par exemple, qui vont devoir être ravitaillés là, avec des navires dans la période estivale. Parce que, dans le fond, dans la période hivernale, la glace étant trop épaisse, on ne pourra pas là, procéder là, à leur ravitaillement, à part par l'avion. Fait que, dans le fond, nous autres, au Canada, on a quand même une industrie là, assez bien développée, là, au niveau du transport maritime.
OK, ben c'est super aidant de savoir comme les différentes composantes un peu de ce transport-là. Parlons, là, parce que tu as publié un article récemment dans le journal Clarté sur l'impact de la COVID sur les travailleurs maritimes. Donc, dans cet article-là, tu as parlé peut-être plus au niveau international plutôt qu'au Québec en particulier, mais j'aimerais ça que tu puisses peut-être nous expliquer un peu ce que tu avais décrit dans l'article, mais aussi parler aussi du Québec, comment est-ce que ça nous influence aussi la COVID pour les travailleurs de la mer.
Oui, absolument. Ben, c'est ça, dans le fond, il faut se mettre une mise en contexte un peu. C'est parce que pourquoi fixer un peu plus les travailleurs internationaux? C'est parce que ici, ce qui est intéressant, c'est que l'industrie maritime est une industrie qui a été fortement syndicalisée. Fait que ici, les syndicats sont très, très forts. Je vous dirais, là, surtout dans les années 70, avant ça, là, c'est une blague qu'on se dit entre marins, là, mais avant ça, c'était généralement là, des gens, par exemple, là, qui sortaient de prison. C'était des gens, par exemple, là, à lesquels il n'y avait pas d'autre emploi ou c'était simplement un petit peu plus payant que travailler, par exemple, dans une usine. Là. C'était des emplois très, très peu payants. Puis après ça, justement, avec la syndicalisation, ça a vraiment augmenté justement les conditions de travail et tout ça. Puis justement, les travailleurs internationaux, ben, c'est des travailleurs généralement c'est des travailleurs qui ont beaucoup évolué, par exemple, au niveau des origines, entre autres. Donc, on va justement le capital en tant que tel, bien, les autres, qu'on appelle l'argent qui se fait par le transit maritime, on appelle ça le fret. Donc, justement, pour maximiser les profits, on va aller chercher des travailleurs à lesquels on peut payer moins. Fait que ça, c'est classique. Fait que dans le fond, on va aller présentement, là, les nations qu'on va aller chercher le plus de marins, généralement aux Philippines. J'ai déjà avec, des Indiens aussi, ou au Bangladesh. Fait que justement, on va pouvoir. Les compagnies vont donner des salaires correspondants justement au standard national. Fait que là, dans le fond, nous, la flotte mondiale était beaucoup, là, il y avait énormément d'Européens, il y avait beaucoup de Canadiens aussi qui fonctionnaient à l'international, puis justement, de manière à essayer de tenir les salaires bas. Donc, justement, ben, sensiblement, ce qui reste aux Canadiens, c'est simplement ce qu'on va appeler le cabotage. Donc, le cabotage qui est protégé par une loi fédérale, donc nous permet, oblige en fait les compagnies quand que un navire va faire deux ports canadiens de suite, que l'équipage soit canadien. Cette loi-là, entre autres, est défendue justement beaucoup par les syndicats parce que c'est justement ça empêcherait là, une ouverture vraiment là, au libre marché finalement. Donc, on conserve justement, les syndicats vont pouvoir conserver leurs acquis. Fait que ça c'est une règle qui est assez importante et qui est défendue, entre autres, là, par le SAU, donc le Syndicat international des marins, entre autres, la Guilde de la marine marchande. Donc, justement, si on se met dans ce contexte-là, entre autres, à l'international, le temps de mer qu'on va effectuer sur un seul navire est relativement très, très long. Donc, on comprend que ici au Québec ou au Canada, donc le système de transport est un peu plus facilitant. Donc, justement, si toi, tu restes à Montréal, on débarque à Rimouski, donc il y a un autobus. Ce qu'on n'aura pas, par exemple, pour quelqu'un qui vient du Bangladesh, qui irait, par exemple, qui débarquerait à Rio de Janeiro, par exemple. Il va falloir prendre l'avion, tout ça. Les compagnies, justement, vont essayer, c'est des coûts. Donc, on va essayer de diminuer ça. Donc, généralement, plus ton grade est bas à bord, plus, justement, tu as besoin de rester longtemps. Donc, par exemple, on peut parler de 9 mois, par exemple. Fait que, 9 mois sur un bateau, c'est très, très long. Là, c'est là que la COVID elle embarque. Donc, on a des gens qui sont embarqués. Donc, ça peut être là, des gens qui ont des familles, tout ça, qui embarquent à bord, qui savent justement que leur contrat est 9 mois. Pourquoi des fois aussi les contrats sont si longs que ça? C'est parce qu'on a aussi des agences de placement qui demandent des frais vraiment exorbitants des fois. Donc, il y a certains marins philippins qui m'avaient déjà dit que les 2 premiers mois qu'ils étaient à bord ne font que payer l'agence de placement là, pour être placé sur le navire. Fait que justement, ils n'ont pas le choix de faire des très, très longs contrats pour justement être en mesure là, de subvenir à leurs besoins et aux autres de leur famille. Donc, on a ces travailleurs-là, justement, qui sont très, très longtemps ces navires et maintenant, on les prend littéralement comme des menaces. Donc, des menaces de vecteurs de maladie, finalement. Donc, vecteurs de la COVID-19. Donc, justement, les ports, dépendant des différentes nations, vont fermer littéralement l'entrée aux marins qui, normalement, devraient retourner chez eux. Donc, à la fin, il n'y a plus de sortie. Donc, on va se cacher en arrière, justement, des mesures sanitaires pour empêcher là, les marins de pouvoir là, profiter du transport puis de retourner à la maison. Donc ça, c'est quelque chose de grave. Puis aussi, pour par exemple, ça pourrait être simplement d'aller chercher des manteaux. Ça pourrait être, il y a beaucoup d'aide qui est faite aux marins. On appelle ça, entre autres, là, il y a les Seaman's Club qu'on appelle, justement, où est-ce que les marins peuvent aller chercher là, des vêtements chauds, des choses comme ça. Puis tout ça, donc, justement, ils perdent l'accès là, à cette partie-là, justement, à cause des mesures sanitaires. Par contre, ce que nous dit l'ITF, finalement, là, le syndicat international des travailleurs maritimes, ce qu'ils nous disent, c'est que c'est un peu ridicule parce qu'en réalité, sur un navire, on est en quarantaine. Fait que théoriquement, justement, si on est testé, donc, le fameux 14 jours, ben, on l'obtient très, très rapidement. Fait que dans le fond, c'est l'argument qui était placé. Même, justement, le syndicat, ce qu'il plaçait, ce serait de donner des sanctions, entre autres, aux nations qui ne reconnaîtraient pas le droit, finalement, là, aux marins de pouvoir débarquer, justement. Fait que là, eux autres, ben, ils sont ouverts à donner des tests, donc, justement, à tester l'équipage. Puis, de cette manière-là, avec la quarantaine, donc c'est toujours les mêmes gens qui sont sur le navire, donc devraient avoir accès là, comment je peux dire ça, à l'accès au pays, finalement.
De pouvoir débarquer, finalement, de pouvoir quitter l'emploi. Ou pas l'emploi, mais de, le lieu de travail, tu sais.
C'est ouais, ça, ils sont emprisonnés, finalement, là, littéralement.
Oui, oui, oui. Ben, tu viens de mentionner la demande du syndicat international. Puis je pense, tu m'avais filé un article, ou non, plutôt, je pense que c'était dans une des déclarations du syndicat en question qui parlait d'un projet pilote, je pense, aux Philippines, peut-être, où c'est que, tu sais, il y avait, le syndicat avait comme pris un hôtel en main pour les marins, justement, tu sais, pour dire, ben garde, on va s'occuper de la quarantaine, on va vous montrer comment que ça se fait, tu sais, on peut le faire. Mais ça a-tu été repris, ça? Est-ce qu'il y a-tu de l'avancement? Ou parce que dans les articles que je lisais là, sur la dernière, dans les derniers 6 mois, peut-être, il y a du monde qui font un an et demi sur un bateau là, maintenant, qui n'ont toujours pas mis le pied à terre, qui ne sont toujours pas rentrés chez eux, puis qui sont toujours sur le même bateau depuis, ben, c'est ça, depuis un an et demi. Donc, y a-tu des avancées là-dedans? Y a-tu des percées à quelque part?
Oui, absolument. Justement, il y a certaines nations qui ont penché justement de ce côté-là, à lesquelles vont offrir des chambres d'hôtel ou vont forcer les compagnies à louer des chambres d'hôtel pour les marins afin d'effectuer la quarantaine. Par contre, justement, les nations, un peu comme j'allais dire, qui vont refuser complètement justement l'accès au navire, oui, il en reste encore. Puis c'est ça qui est dommage un peu. Nous, on travaille énormément avec ce qu'on appelle l'Organisation maritime internationale, puis aussi le comment on appelle ça, la Commission du travail international, justement, ben, la partie qui... Puis généralement, c'est eux autres qui vont faire des mesures qui vont toucher toutes les nations signataires. Fait que dans le fond, si tu as signé, ben, l'OMI, en fait, l'Organisation maritime internationale, c'est un organe de l'ONU. Donc, justement, il y a des conventions qui ont été signées, par exemple, à la suite du Titanic. Donc, à la suite du Titanic, on a remarqué qu'il y avait des failles au niveau de la construction, au niveau de tout ça. Donc, on a sorti des conventions qui doivent être signées par les États-nations. Dans ce cas-ci, c'est laissé un peu au cas par cas. Fait que dans le fond, chaque nation, il n'y a pas eu encore de pied à terre qui a été fait là, de la partie vraiment internationale pour dire de manière uniforme de la façon qu'on va fonctionner. Fait que toi, si tu es pris sur une run, sur des voyages fixes, en fait, entre deux pays qui n'acceptent pas justement que les marins descendent, ben, théoriquement, justement, ben, tu es prisonnier de ton navire, finalement, là, malheureusement.
Incroyable. Puis ça, je veux dire, c'est du monde qui sont vraiment sur leur navire depuis peut-être potentiellement le mois de mars, voire février de l'an dernier.
Oui, exactement. Puis en fait, probablement bien avant ça. Là, tu sais, dans le fond, 6 mois, moi...
Non, justement, c'est ça. Si ton contrat, c'était 9 mois, puis t'es arrivé à bout au mois de mars l'an dernier, ben c'est comme t'es... je comprends les maths, là.
Ah, oh, exact. Fait que, tu sais, ça remonte à vraiment loin. Fait que, tu sais, puis, comment je dirais ça? Ça joue beaucoup parce que, dans le fond, c'est un métier qui est relativement... qui demande beaucoup d'attention. Il y a de la fatigue qui embarque. Entre autres, moi, je donnais un cours, justement, sur la gestion du personnel en institut. On parle beaucoup, justement, de la gestion du stress, la gestion aussi de la fatigue. Donc, au niveau du stress, ben c'est sûr que t'as pas pris sur ce qu'est-ce qui se passe à la maison. Fait que là, présentement, est-ce que tu as un enfant qui est malade, tout ça, tu sais. Fait que tout ça, tu peux pas aller porter vraiment... comment je pourrais dire ça? Des fois, on n'a pas Internet du tout, fait qu'on ne peut pas communiquer. Avant ça, justement, dans ce que j'appelais les Seamen's Club, les marins pouvaient descendre puis avaient accès à Internet. Fait que là, de cette façon-là, ils pouvaient communiquer avec leur famille. Fait que là, dans ce cas-là, c'est plus possible. Ensuite de ça, au niveau de la fatigue, fait que justement, ceux qui vont faire là, des petits voyages, donc qui ne feront pas des très longs, ils vont souvent aller au port, donc ils vont se faire réveiller, là, par exemple, de nuit ou pas dans leur corps. Donc, justement, c'est de la fatigue qui s'accumule. Ensuite de ça, ben, ça peut mener à des accidents. Fait que là, ben, là, ça embarque justement la santé et sécurité. Fait que là, qu'est-ce qui se passe, par exemple, si à cause de la fatigue accumulée, par exemple, comme moi, ben, je perds un bout de doigt, ben, à ce moment-là, ben, c'est ça, ça amène des accidents. Fait que, ça amène des accidents, ça amène de la déprime, ça amène. Fait que, il y a plusieurs effets là, à cette crise-là. Là.
Oui, je pense que le syndicat international des marins du Canada, notamment, parlait là, du danger, en particulier avec les accidents, pas de la personne. Là. Mettons, tu ne perds pas ton pouce, mais tu crashes ton navire. Puis là, ça peut être des marées noires, ça peut être des déversements de pétrole, des déversements de marchandises, des accidents d'import, des accidents entre bateaux, toutes sortes d'affaires de même qui... Je veux dire, ça. Pas pour diminuer l'importance de la santé physique des gens, ni la santé mentale, non, entre autres, mais ça a aussi des impacts sur des gens qui ne sont pas ces bateaux non plus. Là.
Absolument.
C'est ça, non, les marées noires, là, ça, c'est, ça fait peur là, de penser à des gens qui sont à bout sur des bateaux, puis les accidents, ça a des impacts extrêmement larges au niveau de la population en général.
Oui, absolument. Puis c'est bien que tu dises ça parce que le comment j'allais dire ça? Il y a tellement, tu sais, moi, justement, comme enseignant, j'étudie beaucoup là, ce qu'on appelle là, les rapports du BST, donc du Bureau de sécurité des transports. Il y en a peut-être qui en ont déjà entendu ou, les rapports, entre autres, là, le lac comment il s'appelle donc l'accident de train qu'il y avait eu. Là, que ça...
Lac Mégantic, là?
Le lac Mégantic. Donc, ceux qui ont fait l'enquête, c'est ce qu'on appelle le BST, donc le Bureau de la sécurité des transports. Puis si on va sur le... c'est tous des rapports, en fait, qui sont publics, donc on peut voir justement les conclusions des enquêtes. Puis je vous dirais que si on regarde les accidents maritimes qu'il y a eu dans les dernières années, il y en a beaucoup, entre autres, qui vont être reliés justement à la fatigue, entre autres. Justement à une mauvaise gestion, par exemple, du stress qui combine parce que le stress. Fait que, tu sais, justement, la partie comme micro, justement, de l'humain qui est en charge, finalement, de la passerelle de la navigation peut amener des effets macro, comme tu dis, justement, littéralement, là, de déversement ou un bateau qui se crache ou ça peut avoir des grandes conséquences, définitivement.
Ben écoute, Alex, as-tu d'autres choses à ajouter, des choses que tu aimerais suggérer au public, aux auditeurs, auditrices qui des places où aller chercher de l'information? Parce que je pense que c'est un sujet qu'on n'a pas beaucoup traité depuis mon arrivée à l'émission, là, mais c'est sûr que c'est une industrie tellement, tellement, tellement importante pour toutes les questions là, de capital international qui nous intéressent. Fait que c'est drôle qu'on n'en parle pas plus. Mais pour ceux et celles qui sont intéressés d'approfondir leurs connaissances, as-tu des suggestions?
Etc. Oui, vous informer, il y a justement beaucoup de sujets. Quelqu'un me faisait remarquer dernièrement la vision très, très... Ben, en fait, la direction des navires, c'est pas tant les marins, mais les navires vraiment qui... vont participer, entre autres, à l'impérialisme. Hein. Dans le fond, on va chercher littéralement là, les ressources, les matières premières dans des pays, par exemple, justement, là, où ce que, le capital là, est en train de le vider, ou, par exemple, qu'il va y avoir de l'extractivisme là, à fond. Puis à ce moment-là, vont ramener les matières premières là, dans les pays fortement industrialisés, mettons, comme le Canada, entre autres. Là. Fait que ça, justement, ça, c'est un vecteur qu'on connaît. Il y a ça s'informe aussi sur la piraterie. La piraterie là, qui se passe, en fait, là, de moins en moins au large de la Somalie, de plus en plus là, dans le golfe de Guinée, là, en face du Nigeria. Donc, on va avoir, là, par exemple, des gens qui, dans leur propre pays, n'auront pas accès à par exemple, l'essence. Puis, par exemple, leur pays en tant que tel est un des plus gros exportateurs. T'sais, dans le fond, on vide le pays là, de ses ressources. Puis, justement, ben on... Fait que, il y a comme... Nous autres, le discours qu'on entend beaucoup, c'est un discours beaucoup colonialiste dans le sens que nous autres, ce qu'on entend, c'est comment empêcher que ça arrive. C'est pas tu sais, comment régler le problème. Tu sais, on est beaucoup d'air, par exemple, bon, mettre du barbelé sur les bateaux, mettre des gardes armés, justement, pour protéger le navire. Mais en tant que tel, tu sais, pour, tu sais, ces gens, tu sais, comme je disais, même en Somalie, c'est un peu la même chose. Là, c'est des gens qui sont généralement désespérés. Donc, par exemple, où est-ce que des bateaux de pêche, qu'on appelle là, des bateaux usines, vont avoir vidé là, leur réserve de poissons. Donc, les pêcheurs se ramassent avec pratiquement rien pour survivre, sont obligés là, de commettre des actes illicites là, pour pouvoir survivre. Fait que c'est intéressant de pousser cette réflexion-là, là, je dirais.
Absolument. Oui. Ben, je pense qu'on pourrait en parler beaucoup plus.
Oui, parce que particulièrement sur la question de bauxite et l'extractivisme et la question de bateau, parce que c'est Stéphane et moi aussi, c'est travail avec un groupe de réfugiés guinéens ici. Ah. Et toujours on fait le lien entre les problématiques, c'est comment nous dit non, vous n'êtes pas le droit pour rester ici, mais s'il vous plaît, nous besoin votre bauxite au ouais. Québec, pas notre place au Québec. Ouais. Ça, c'est vraiment la question de la ligne. So, c'est vraiment pour la question de le secteur de marine et votre région, c'est vraiment le secteur de bauxite et la transformation de l'aluminium, c'est vraiment important à ce niveau ou?
Ben oui, parce que dans le fond, nous autres, la bauxite, l'aluminium, c'est nous autres, si on prend cette île, il y a Alouette, si on prend, il y a, comment ça s'appelle, Rio Tinto, entre autres, qui produit de l'aluminium. Fait que nous autres, on est vraiment une plaque tournante un peu de la fabrication d'aluminium. Fait que c'est sûr que moi, j'ai personnellement, quand j'étais en stage, j'ai été au Brésil, entre autres, justement chargé là, bauxite et aluminium. J'ai été en Jamaïque aussi, bauxite aluminium. Fait que oui, là, tu sais, justement, notre industrie, elle, littéralement, là, dépend de ces importations-là. Là. C'est pas des matériaux vraiment là, qu'on a ici, du moins là, dans la partie est du Canada. Je pourrais pas dire si dans le Canada, il y en a vraiment pas, mais c'est vraiment là, dans le continent sud-américain là, qu'on a ce type de produit-là. Là.
Ben super, ben merci beaucoup Alex. Comme je disais, là, on pourrait en parler super longtemps parce que puis peut-être qu'on devra te reparler un jour.
Parfait. Hein?
Ouais. Ben merci beaucoup. Puis ben c'est ça, on va dire à la prochaine, hein, c'est ça.
Excellent.
And welcome back to Labor Radio here on CKUT 95.9 FM in Montreal. I'm joined on the line right now, on the Zoom line. By Simon Black. He's the lead organizer with Labor Against the Arms Trade, and he also teaches in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University. Thanks for joining us today, Simon.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Pleasure is all mine. Let's maybe get started. Can you briefly just explain to us what is Labor Against the Arms Trade? And maybe you can talk briefly about some of the latest actions that you've done since the beginning of 2021, just as a way of sort of introducing what kind of work that you guys do.
Yeah, so Labor Against the Arms Trade is a coalition of peace and labor activists, which was founded to work to end Canada's participation in the international arms trade. And we organize for arms conversion and a just transition. So at the center of our work is not only work towards disarmament and work towards the end of war and participation in war, but to ensure that arms industry workers have their livelihoods protected, and that we want to see the conversion of arms industries towards green, peaceful production, and the skills and capacities of arms industry workers used towards socially useful production, as opposed to used towards the production of weapons of war. So we were founded about a year back now, and we were initially founded as a way to drum up labor movement opposition to Canada's $15 billion arms deal with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
So recently, Labor Against the Arms Trade was in the news. You had at least a banner drop that I saw in, I think it was Toronto, against the CN shipping arms that are, like you mentioned, going to Yemen, or I should say against Yemen. They're not really going to Yemen per se. And then also, I think you got some international attention at the end of January when you were blocking trucks leaving an arms plant outside of Hamilton, I believe. Do you want to talk a bit about those actions?
Yeah, let me give you a little bit of context for those actions. So we are very much inspired by a wave of workers, dock workers around the world, mainly in Europe, in the ports in France and Italy, Genoa and Le Havre and Marseille, who had refused and declared what in the labor movement, what we call hot cargo, had refused to handle arms from Europe and the US that were destined for Saudi Arabia, which were being deployed in the war in Yemen. Of course, Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, as the United Nations declared last year, or the year before. We're now at the point where famine is gripping parts of Yemen. There are close to 400,000 children who the World Food Program has said are on the verge of starvation. And this is largely as a result of the Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and the blockade that has essentially closed Yemeni ports, and the Saudi government is refusing to allow fuel to enter those ports or shipping, any shipping companies, fuel transportation into the ports. So we're in a situation now where there are a severe humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And this is part of an ongoing, now it's coming up to the sixth year, which will be on March 26th or 25th, the six-year anniversary of the Saudi-UAE military intervention in Yemen. And that is an intervention which is Western-backed. The Saudi and the UAE are supplied with arms from the West, from France, Italy, from the United States, and from Canada. Canada has its largest arms deal in Canadian history with Saudi Arabia, which is an arms deal which provides Saudi with $15 billion worth of light armored vehicles, which for your listeners, light armored vehicle sounds kind of innocuous, but these are essentially tanks on wheels. And they are being deployed in Yemen, and they've also been used in Saudi Arabia to put down internal unrest, protests for democracy and reform in Saudi Arabia. So we saw in 2018 this wave of kind of worker actions by dock workers in Europe who were saying that we refuse to be complicit in this war, and we're taking action. And it just so happened that in Canada in December 2018, a group of peace activists had set up a picket line, a peace picket outside a port, the port of St. John in New Brunswick. And they set up that peace picket, and the workers, the dock workers at the Port of St. John, who are members of a very proud union local, the International Longshoremen's Association, Local 273, they refused to cross that peace picket. And the Saudi ship, which was off the coast of New Brunswick, for a day at least, those light armored vehicles could not be loaded onto that ship. So we looked at that example, we took inspiration from that example, and we said, you know, we mustn't wait for government to put an end to war, to put an end to Canada's participation in the arms industry, to put an end to Canada's complicity in the war in Yemen. Workers can actually do that by refusing to participate in the war industry. So we've taken a number of actions to drum up labor movement opposition to this arms deal, including two pan-Canadian days of action, the first in June and then the second in September of last year. And we have worked to get Canadian unions and unions in Quebec as well to mobilize their resources to demand that the Trudeau government put an end to this arms deal and to ensure there's a just transition for arms industry workers. So these light armor vehicles are actually manufactured in London, Ontario, by members of Unifor, Canada's largest private sector union, who work at General Dynamics Land Systems there, which is a subsidiary of General Dynamics, a big part of the military industrial complex in the United States. And in those two pan-Canadian days of action, we've had the Canadian Labour Congress sign on to opposition to Canada's arms deal with Saudi Arabia, Public Service Alliance of Canada, QP, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, and a number of other unions, the BC General Employees Union as well. So we've been working hard on drumming up opposition, labor movement opposition to the arms industry and to this arms deal in particular. And then we've been also taking direct action. So as you mentioned, January 25th, Labor Against the Arms Trade joined with World Beyond War Canada to blockade a trucking company in Hamilton, just outside of Toronto, Paddock Transport International, which has a contract with General Dynamics to be shipping these light armored vehicles to the Port of Baltimore. They take them down by flatbed truck. So we've been engaging in direct action, and also that banner drop you mentioned on the CN Rail Bridge in Toronto, which was trying to bring to light the CN Rail's complicity in this arms deal as well, because these light armored vehicles have been transported not only by truck, but by rail to port.
Right on. Well, I know that you've also mentioned, I can't remember where I saw this, but so the Canadian Labour Congress convention is coming up in June. And so is there any activity regarding their position in terms of what you guys are advocating for with the transition that you're mentioning? And it makes me think particularly in terms of the Vice President Don LaFleur's trip to Syria and his advocacy against sanctions on Syria, which was kind of, he was basically censored and nearly thrown out of his post and so on. And so basically anti-imperialist positions are definitely controversial, let's say. And so the idea that you kind of think of the labor movement as a natural ally of the peace movement, but I think like what you're talking about sort of shows that it's a bit more complex than that. And so do you want to talk about those links between organized labor at the sort of highest levels in Canada and the struggle that you're engaged in?
Yeah, I think, to be short, there's a lot of work to be done to build an anti-war and anti-imperialist politics in the labor movement. That's work that we're committed to. Labor Against the Arms Trade is kind of one entryway for workers, for rank and file trade unionists and labor activists to get involved in anti-war and anti-imperialist action within the labor movement. I think that the Canadian Labor Congress convention that's coming up this summer provides us with an opportunity to build these politics. I think the arms deal with Saudi Arabia, along with the question of Palestine and the Israeli occupation of Palestine, are going to be issues that rank and file trade unionists, that members of various unions are active around, will continue to be active around, and will continue to try to build support around these issues in the Canadian labor movement and in Quebec as well. So we see this as an opportunity to kind of build an anti-imperialist and anti-war politics in the Canadian labor movement. But it's going to be tough work, like you say, that there's, you know, we have to recognize that there's many workers who are unionized, who are work in plants each day that are manufacturing weapons of war. The plant, as I mentioned, in General Dynamics in London, it's a Unifor plant, and the work to get a union like Unifor on board with a movement or a campaign to end this arms deal with Saudi Arabia means that we need to build the capacities in order to demand alternatives for arms industry workers. It's not enough to just go down to the plant gate in London and tell these workers that you're complicit in war and famine in Yemen. You need to provide alternatives. I mean, the good thing is that if you go down to that plant gate in London and you say to those workers, you have a choice. You have a choice between manufacturing weapons of war, or you can use your skills and capacities to build the green infrastructures and renewable technologies we need to confront the climate crisis, then there's going to be very few workers who actually choose to be manufacturing weapons of war. You say you can have the same wages, the same benefits, the same security, building the things we need to confront the climate crisis, to confront climate change. You're not going to find a worker there who says, I prefer to be manufacturing tanks destined for Yemen. You won't. But they don't have that choice. So what Labor Against the Arms Trade needs to do, what we in the labor movement need to do, is to demand of government, demand of the state, that workers be given that choice, that workers have that choice. And that's a campaign, that's a politics that we're going to need to build over time. There's no shortcuts to that kind of politics.
Well, thanks so much, Simon. And we'll definitely be following the work of Labor Against the Arms Trade going forward.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Press record and we're recording. And actually, I didn't ask you, Marianne, how you want to be introduced.
Yeah, just Marianne Miller. My Facebook name is incorrect.
Okay.
So my students can't Google me. Member of Progressive Education Workers.
Okay. Just your first name too?
You can use my last name, Marianne Miller.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not Marianne Muller. I see. Yeah. I see the
it's very sneaky.
Okay. So,
the teenagers can't see.
Yeah, they could never figure it out. Awesome. Okay. Well, welcome back to Labor Radio on CKUT 95.9 FM. We're joined on the Zoom line by Marianne Miller. She's with the Progressive Teachers Association. Thanks for joining us back on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So maybe to get us started, I think a lot of people who've been paying attention to the news a bit have seen that things are really sort of moving quickly within the education sector on lots of fronts, but notably on the strike vote front. And so just for our listeners who maybe are seeing it in the news and it's kind of all bits and pieces, this place voted for a strike mandate, this place elsewhere voted. And so to get us, can you give us like a sort of broad picture of where things are at with that whole negotiation and these strike votes that are happening?
Yeah, so teachers unions, our collective agreement ran out last March. So we've been slowly negotiating, and then we had a mediator in December and January, and we've really been at a standstill. So in January, the two big provincial level unions, so FSCS-CSQ and FAE, each individually started setting up plans for a strike. And so FSE proposed to their members a 5-day strike, with the days to be determined at some point in the future. And most of their members have adopted that. So when you see the strike votes rolling in, it's local members, you know, English Montreal teachers, teachers of La Naudière, teachers of wherever. They've been slowly adopting the 5-day mandate. I think they're pretty much done. And then FAE members, which is 9 unions who are mostly around the island of Montreal, plus Quebec City. Our provincial union proposed to us a general unlimited strike that would start 31st of May and go on until demands were met. And so at this point, we only have 2 unions left to vote on that mandate. Most of our locals have also adopted that mandate. So almost all teachers in Quebec now have a strike mandate, be it for 5 days or general unlimited.
So I think people get fairly excited when they hear a general unlimited strike. Do you want to tell us about what you sort of foresee with that? Because I know like sometimes that's just a pressure mechanism to say, look, we could go on strike and we could go on unlimited strike. May 31st is just a tiny bit before the end of the school year. So can you give us sort of like a nuanced view of like where you think that that's going?
Yes, so it is very exciting to hear that thrown around. And it is scary. It does hold the power. It's not just something we say we're going to do. We have those pretty strongly adopted strike mandates. A lot of locals adopted at like 85%, 87%, 92% in the case of Utawe. And so the idea is kind of the first day of a general unlimited strike is a lot scarier than 5 days that you see coming in advance. And actually the week in February when our union proposed to its members, let's vote on the GGI, that week the government said, okay, why don't we send you Minister Sonia Labelle to the negotiation table and the unions can negotiate directly with her this week and we'll see if that gets us anywhere. And that was before our members even adopted the strike mandate. So just when that rumor started, it actually moved us a little step further in the negotiation. So I think that really shows that it does have an effect, especially because teachers haven't had a GGI in about 40 years. So it's not, you know, oh, we'll try and give them a little strike mandate, see if they move. It's pretty serious, the fact that we've actually adopted this tactic. Who knows? We still have another 2 whole months at the negotiation table, so we might not go on strike. We might go for 5 days and then stop our GGI. But I think that the power of the GGI, it's a much higher risk that we're taking. And so that does bring a level of seriousness to the negotiation table.
And has there been any strategizing? Because there's been the action that that happened this past Sunday and that brought together sort of a coalition of different, not just teachers and education workers, but also other essential workers, sort of the strategy leading up to the possibility of a grève générale limité. So like the kind of the strategy, especially thinking maybe not at the official union level, but at the rank and file level as well in the lead up to the strike, if the possibility of a strike.
Yes, so I think that part of what our action was about this past Sunday is that lack of common front that we've seen in the last year with public sector negotiations, but also with essential workers throughout this whole pandemic. There could have been common fronts of all the people who were sent back to work, of all the people who had fears about their safety. And I think that our group, Progressive Education Workers, that's kind of a gap we're always trying to fill. When we see that our actual unions are not taking advantage of those moments for crossover and solidarity between groups, that's when we try and come in and see how we can do that on a rank and file level. So unfortunately, there hasn't been a public sector common front this time around with our unions, but we've had several meetings that we've called like Le Front Commun de la Base. How can we as rank and file members try and build that common front and try and use it? You know, unfortunately, the nurses, for example, signed their agreement before 2021 started, like before the break. So that's kind of a lost opportunity. It would be great if next time around we can really build that common front. So we say we're all going to wait and we won't sign until everybody's happy across the board, the healthcare workers and the teachers and the school maintenance workers and everybody.
In terms of like the, I mean, just because it would be, and what are you imagining in terms of that being part of it, but actually kind of going forward, you know, because there is 2 months still of negotiation, right? So like, what are you imagining? What are the potentials in terms of pressure tactics that could be put on the table between now and then?
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunate because some of our process was actually done backwards. Like we're meeting this week at our union to talk about pressure tactics. We kind of jumped from, okay, everyone wear your toque on Wednesdays to, okay, we're going to have a strike mandate. And there was not a lot of buildup in between. So I'm really hoping that we'll be able to use these next 2 months to do some of that buildup, whether it's having more manifs and protests on the weekends, or whether it's, you know, starting to flyer parents after school and build that solidarity with the parents and the communities around the schools about what our demands are. I think we have to fit a lot actually of mobilization in those next 2 months. because if it doesn't work, that's what will also build our momentum towards the strike. But I think we're at a place in this year that we're so burnt out by COVID and we're so tired of the conditions that have been changing every 2 minutes and have been unsafe and have been unstable. I think the teachers are ready to get into kind of some of the heavier tactics, and the fact that we kind of so easily adopted the strike without a lot of mobilization from the part of our unions, I think it shows that we're actually like grating the bottom of the barrel in terms of the free goodwill that teachers are ready to give. I think there's going to be a turnaround that's coming. We've felt the impacts of the teacher shortage in Montreal so intensely. All of our paraprofessionals in the schools are leaving and are burning out. I think that there's going to have to be a turnaround because we've gotten to such a low point in public education.
I mean, one of the things that gets brought up all the time around teacher strikes, and I mean, like, to a certain degree, all strikes, like, let's be real, but teacher strikes in particular, is how much that the public is against them. And we're seeing this year how, like, not only is that context sort of always present of like the media particularly like hammering against teachers and public sector workers in general, but now you're kind of like the safety valve of the entire economy, or at least that's made very clear because of COVID. So how do you see that kind of like I don't know how to say, but like public relations or media or kind of ideological struggle happening with how did you defend your right to strike and sort of show that it's being done in the public good against, I think, like a kind of common tactic of the other side of the bargaining table, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is hard in the context where kids have already missed so much school in the past year. But I think that since we've gone back to school in September, parents have seen that teachers are just as helpless in the midst of this crisis and in the midst of the disorganization of the Minister of Education as they are. And so I think that parents do feel a bit more solidarity now that they've seen, oh my goodness, when a class closes, the teacher's really struggling to teach my kids on Zoom for 2 weeks. I'm struggling to have my kid at home and they have to try and do their math teacher. Like there is kind of a shared struggle that's been happening, and they see that it's not the teacher's fault, all of the disorganization. The fact that report cards got changed like 4 times, they know that that's not the teacher's fault. So I think there is a sympathy there actually, a little bit from the side of parents. But the other side is really the fact that the de-investment of funds in education has gotten to such a low point that parents feel it directly also. So parents at my school are aware that we started this year in September with 3 resource teachers to help kids who have additional struggles, who are trying to catch up. And because of burnouts and teacher shortage and reorganizing of human resources, we're down to 0.2 resource teachers. So we have 1 day a week of a resource teacher at our school when we had 3 full-time people at the beginning of the year. So just the number of kids that got an hour of help a day, or, you know, 2 hours a week of extra help, is now down to like 4 kids at our school. And so the parents feel that directly. I think parents are worried about mold and lead in the water. Like, I think that we're at such a point with the underfunding of schools that we can really build on that. Like, we have to build that relationship still, education workers. We have to go out and be talking to parents much more than we've done before. But I think that we can actually build on that common ankyotsu, that common worry for the state of our schools.
Mustafa, do you want to have the last question?
The one thing which is interesting is when you talk about the sort of the sympathy, and I know one thing, thinking through in Ontario, and is also being a parent as well, and has there been any discussion in terms of trying to build or to support the organizing of, let's say, parent committees in support of education workers? Or you know, we saw the student walkout in January, right? And so has there been discussions, because is that the most maybe effective way of solidarity that people outside of directly who aren't teachers, but a lot of people will have children in the system, right? And will be parents. And so trying to think of ways of, you know, because also not just pushing things within the union, but also outside of the union, that this is an issue that belongs to all of us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So our group Progressive Education Workers, we're trying to build some strong links with groups that already exist. For example, Je Protège Mon École Publique or Debout pour l'École Publique. Like, there are several groups in Montreal that are parents trying to be involved with that fight for public schools. And I think that the more we can be building those community links, like just encouraging our colleagues to stay outside the school for a couple of minutes at the end of the day and just chat with the parents of our students. Like, I think that we have to build those informal relationships. We have to build them with the advocacy groups that exist, and we have to be more engaged in the communities around each school. And I think we have to broaden our scope in terms of what we're fighting for. And I think that's a really key part of our long-term vision at Progressive Education Workers, is that we have to be fighting for our conditions and the conditions of kids in schools, but also the conditions of families in neighborhoods. And so when we start broadening our scope of, like, we are teachers fighting for affordable housing and fighting for status for all and fighting against poverty, then that's when we are going to have much more significant relationships built with parents and communities. So that's the long-term vision and dream. And I think slowly, with the kind of rassemblement we had on this past Sunday and with different alliances we're building with different groups, as a member of Defund the Police Montreal and of Coalition Main Rouge and all these little connections we're trying to make, that's kind of the long-term goal.
That's great. It's a good long-term goal.
Yeah, and it was a really great action on Sunday, and it was really diverse. It kind of showed that, like, the strategy is really beginning to work. So
good. I hope so. Well, no, it was great to have so many allies and co-sponsors of that event, and it brought a lot of energy and a lot of voices. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with us today, Marianne, and look forward to sort of seeing the downstream effects of all this great work that you all are doing, and hearing about it and hopefully talking about it more on the show in the future too.
Yeah, and also, Marianne, how can people get in touch if they want to support the Progressive Education Workers Network and kind of stay up to date?
Yes, so we have currently a Facebook page, Travailleurs et Travailleurs Progressistes de l'Education, Progressive Education Workers. That's kind of where the most action is right now. But then from the page, you can get on our email listserv where we'll let you know when future activities are coming up. So I really invite you to come and follow our page.
Thank you again so much, Marianne, for being here on CKUT 90.3 FM on Labor Radio.
Thanks so much.
And you've been listening to Labor Radio. Those were three incredible interviews with Simon Black, Marianne Miller, and Alexandre
Courtois.
And again, it's funding drive, sowing the seeds of grassroots change. Make your donation, pledge monthly or one time, whatever you can, $1, $10, $100. You can go to ckut.ca/donate and just mark that you've been listening to Labor Radio. You can also mail a check, or you can call 448-4041. And please support CKUT. This year more than ever, we really need our independent, community-based media.
Perfect. They can't say we...
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to cket.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds, sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds of change.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, March 18th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guest,